mashed potatoes might be the best thing ever made. Other potato dishes are not far behind. Today is the much anticipated by me anyway, potato episode from the Escoffier series. Do you have a favorite potato dish? Is there a tradition handed down in your family about how that dish is made? What we'll discover is many of Escoffier's procedures are variations on a theme. Shapes, round or oval, browned in butter on the stovetop, mashed potatoes and sometimes mixed with other ingredients for new procedures, or in some cases, baked and then baked again. There's a lot to cover and plenty of inspiration for more ideas, so stick around. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 293, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here, and welcome back to the show. I have been a head chef, a head baker, and a culinary school instructor. I've cooked more than a few potatoes in more than a few ways. They are a simple tuber that can be adopted and used in dozens of ways. This episode covers some of Escoffier's procedures to get some of the basics down. The innovation possibilities are almost endless, so let's dive in. It seems like a long time coming. We're finally at the potatoes portion of Chapter 13. Escoffier lists 59 different procedures for potatoes. That covers many. In true Escoffier fashion, add one element to any procedure and you create a whole new procedure. And that makes the variations increase by a magnitude, maybe even infinite, if you consider the variety we now have of potato choices. Now, Escoffier will rely on a few cooking procedures to get his many variations of potatoes. Cooked in butter or a clarified fat, which for us could be lard, duck fat, goose fat, schmaltz, tallow, cooked on the stovetop is one method of cooking small cuts or small pieces of potato. Pomme de terre chateau or fondant are two examples. Baking the potato is another. It can be the case that baking is the final step in a series of cooking steps. Pomme de terre duchesse or duchess is one example, and I make no claims whatsoever to be correct in my French pronunciation. Deep frying is, of course, a much appreciated cooking method for potatoes. You may recall back in the chicken chapter we mentioned chicken Maryland. It's fried chicken. It will then be no surprise to you to learn that there is an Escoffier procedure for pomme de terre chip or potato chips. The last major process for various potato dishes is puree. He'll use the puree for mashed potatoes, of course, and then for a variety of procedures, which will include croquettes, and then we'll also advance from that. Some procedures are outliers. Pommes Anna is one of them. They are thin, uniform slices of potato layered in concentric circles in a thin layer in a thick bottom pan, coated well with butter, salted, and finely baked. Now, the ideal version is crispy in the outside, and where the potato meets its buddies is kind of tender. Now, it takes some fair amount of trickery, and that's trickery is wrong. It takes a little bit of skill. It takes a little bit of innovation to get there. When you finally get them, these things are really fantastic. But it takes a little bit of practice. It takes a little bit of work. When I was working at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Naples, every vegetable got more attention than you would give it at home. We did something called tourné cut, which means the vegetable, carrot, parsnip, potato, beet, was cut into a uniform seven-sided oval shape, tapered on both ends. Zucchini and yellow squash were a very popular veg for tourné because it has that flat colored surface. We didn't go for seven. It was usually probably four or five or six, but we kept that color because that was the main thing. In all cases, trimmed pieces that were not servable, and there was an immense amount of that, were just waste. At best, one Idaho potato yielded four tourné potatoes. Those cuts of veg were used in both fine dining outlets, there was two of them, the grill and the dining room, and also for the banquet department. In some cases, the executive chef and any free cook stood around a table in front of the chef's office, tourneing vegetables over garbage cans. And sometimes we went through cases a veg just to get the required number of tourné potatoes. Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of waste. Tourné veg make for attractive and uniform pieces. Cooking time is perhaps the best reason to keep vegetables uniform. Aesthetics, of course, comes into play here. Knife skills are important here. A carrot cut into, now we're moving from tournés to different cuts, a carrot cut into a cube 1/8 inch square will not cook the same as a carrot cut into a cube of 1/4 inch or 1/2 inch. So while we won't be dealing with the precise dicing knife skills here, that's one of the main reasons for tourneing veggies is uniform cooking and a pleasant appearance. Tourneed potatoes or anything else is not a goal for home cooks. Potatoes for Anna potatoes should be cut into round cylinders. Now, again, this could be something you do at home, but you could also take your chances without cutting it the way we did. Now, to get the uniformity of a perfectly round potato coin, we would, this is innovation. If you look under your sink or your bathroom sink, from the drain is a 8 or 10 inch piece of pipe. That pipe is generally 1.5 inches, maybe it's 2 inches. That's a perfect die to cut your potato. So you peel it, you don't even have to peel it. Put your potato on the long side up, maybe cut the bottom flat so it stands, and you push down and cut out this big plug of Idaho potato. Russets will be our main thing. I'll cover that in a second. And then on a mandolin, cut them very, very thin. Usually for an Anna potato, 1/8 inch, I think metric, that's probably 3 millimeters, is just about the size you want to have. Now, I have not tried making Anna potatoes with a box cutter like you have in your kitchen. They would be uniform, no doubt, but I think most box cutters cut too thick. They're more than 1/8 inch. That may not be true for all cases. On the subject of uniform shapes, melon ballers are useful tools. They come in at least three sizes. There's a melon baller, which is one is slightly larger than the other, and one of them is called the Parisian, and I can't remember which one is. There's a third size, which is called the petit pois, which is the French word for pea, which makes pea-sized pieces of whatever vegetable you're melon balling. Again, an aesthetic is the main purpose here, and uniform cooking. Petit pois potatoes look pretty. It's a lot of waste. I don't recommend doing it at home, but you could. Now, Escoffier offers pommes de terre noisette, which is potatoes cut into ball shapes with that melon ball tool, pan-fried to golden brown and crispy. A holiday dinner might be a reason to make these potatoes, and the guts could be made into mashed potatoes or make mashed potatoes, then turn that into potato bread, which would be potato rolls for the next day, a lot of work, but I'll tell you what, potato bread made from homemade mashed potatoes is pretty stinking good. One very important cooking note is the potatoes. If you're doing diced or any of those round shapes, or even if you're doing tournées, whatever you're doing, the critical part is that the potatoes must be in one layer. Every piece of potato must touch the pan. If it doesn't do that, what happens is the potatoes that are the second layer are going to get steamed as the potato cooks. Potatoes have a lot of water. It's sort of obvious, but you don't necessarily know how much water is in there. And from potato to potato, it can vary. As the potato cooks, the water turns to steam and rises up. Of course, we know that part. As it's doing that, that hot steam is starting to cook. In the chemical sense, it is transforming the starches, sugars, and protein. Well, not a lot of protein in potato. So the starches and sugars are being altered chemically by that steam, and the starch is gelatinizing. That's fine if we want steamed potatoes. The big problem is that when that slightly gelatinized starch on the potato on the second layer touches the pan, there's a very good possibility instead of browning, it's going to stick and not release and cause little bits of potato to stick on the bottom of your pan, and those are going to burn before everything else cooks, and now we have a problem. That problem is not really easily fixed. You can increase the heat of the pan and add more fat, but as long as there's still steaming happening because there's too many potatoes in the pan, that problem doesn't go away. So all that is to say, do not overcrowd your pan. If you have a lot of potatoes, you need a bigger pan or you need two pans. Escoffier's preferred potato for most dishes is what he calls a Dutch potato. Now, if you go to the grocery store, you can expect to get blank stares from the produce staff if you ask for a Dutch potato. What he means is an older potato with a lot of starch. Now, at our grocery store, we don't have a lot of control over the age of the potato we buy. And I'm going to guess, complete conjecture, that the bigger the potato is, the older the potato is, and there's probably some reasonableness to that assessment, barring a few things. In the russet family, that's possibly true. The main thing we want is lots of starch. So the red skin potatoes, the little fingerling potatoes, the little tiny round ones of, they could be purple potatoes, actually have a lot of starch. But for many of the things we're going to be talking about today, except for mashed potatoes, they may not work. I've not tried all of them. I've never made croquettes from purple potatoes, but I have made mashers from purple potatoes. They look kind of fun and they taste really good. But we're sticking with russets or Idahos for all of the dishes we're making here. Now, Yukon Golds are often mentioned in contemporary recipes for mashed potatoes, and they do taste good. They are slightly less starchy than russets, which will mean they can hold less butter and milk or cream, but they will also be very smooth as a finished mashed potato product. The starch is critical for a thing like the Anna potato sticking to each other while it's in the pan. And in the pan, we have to make sure that we're using, cast iron actually happens to be very good for this, as long as the cast iron pan is well seasoned and no bits stuck in the pan, then it should be fine. And they make little 4-inch cast iron pans. The pan makers, also make black steel pans about 4 inches, and we use those a lot. Those are a dream. Those are fantastic. Now, you can't do very much in them except for making perfectly caramelized potato things, but boy, are they good for that. So of published chef authors, and there's more than a few, Joël Robuchon, who passed a few years ago, made his name in part for a potato puree that is sublime. Now, you don't know potatoes could be this good. Such a procedure is more time-consuming than most people are willing to give, which is fair enough. I'll mention the details quickly. 2 pounds of russet potatoes, washed, left whole, not peeled. Cook in well-salted water until they are just done. Remove the potatoes from the water, and while they're still quite warm, peel the skins with a sharp knife, keeping in mind that those potatoes are hot. You'll need a rag in your hand. Puree the potatoes through a fine meshed screen into a pot or a pan and dry the puree on a low burner with a wooden spoon over the stove top. Cut 2 sticks of butter into 8 pieces each and scald about 3/4 cup of milk and have that set aside. Dry the potatoes in the pan on the stovetop with a wooden spoon until the steam mostly stops rising from the pan and you see light streaks of potato beginning to stick to the bottom of the pan. Turn the heat to very low. Start adding the chunks of butter 1 or 2 at a time, stirring carefully so that you don't splash melted butter on you or maybe the hot potato. And as you add more butter, it will get more fluid and more risk of splashing. As those chunks start to melt, add the next 1 or 2 at a time, making sure that the first additions are nearly melted before the next one goes in. After all the butter is in, drizzle in 1/2 of the milk, stirring very carefully. Check the consistency and the seasoning. And at this point, it's going to be a pretty loosey-goosey mashed potato. It's not going to look like mashers at all. It's not really going to hold the shape, which is entirely the goal. These potato purees are going to just sort of sit flat on the plate. So Robuchon would serve them in a small dish of a kind and then make a pretty little pattern with the edge of a spoon to make a design on the top, and that's it. The home version will almost require the use of a fine-plated food mill. Most ricer tools, if maybe your grandma had one of those, are too coarse, and certainly more coarse than the fine plate on a food mill. This will make a very satisfactory second, that food mill. The puree passed through a fine screen, which they're sometimes called tammis, T-A-M-M-I-S. They can be either metal. Well, they look kind of like a drum without a top or a drum without a bottom. So usually they're 3 to 4 inches. They can be any diameter. I've seen them from 8 up until 16 inch diameter, either bamboo or metal. The screen on the, I'm assuming the bamboo, it could be something else. The screen on the wooden ones is often bronze or brass and very, very fine. The metal tammy is often a bit wider. It's kind of like window screen, maybe just a bit smaller than that. They may call them sifters in the food restaurant store. But those are designed so you would use those, well, for making this puree. You could also pass chicken things through there or any kind of vegetable if you wanted to make a vegetable or chicken mousse, but that's another show. We did that already. Making the puree, drying it out, adding the butter and the cream, or milk in this case, and that's your potato puree. Mashed potatoes are often made from peeled potatoes cut into chunks. It's faster, which certainly is a benefit. The starch exposed by peeling and cutting the potato either goes down the drain as the potatoes are drained and the starch just goes away, and the finished product is inferior for that much less starch. Cooking the potatoes in the skin preserves nearly all the possible starch, which is vital to hold the butter and the cream. And as we'll see, vital for most of Escoffier's dishes or mashers are the first step. Now, for you playing at home, you are correct that this is the way for nearly all of Escoffier's procedures. Croquette de pomme de terre is one of the exceptions to the guide. It's the second exception. The first exception, interestingly, is his own mashed potatoes. Robuchon cooked them whole in the skins, which was his innovation. Now, Robuchon was no slouch, and his change makes sense. Cooking potatoes whole saves the work of rescuing the starch. Escoffier decided that instead of doing all that, we're going to cut them and cook them in boiling salted water and cook them until they remain a bit firm. The distinction here, and this is an important one, cooking the potatoes in already boiling water gelatinizes the starch just like the steam rising up from that crowded pan of stovetop potatoes will gelatinize the starch. As the potato is going in the water, that starch gelatinization is kind of sealing the potato from releasing the starch that's inside. That's the goal. We want as much starch inside as possible. So in both cases, cooking it in boiling water or cooking them in their skins minimizes the starch loss, and that is the critical part. Now, just for reference, Escoffier uses 7 ounces of butter for every kilo, which is 2.25 pounds approximately, of potatoes. 7 ounces of butter for 2.25 pounds of potatoes and 9 ounces of milk. Robuchon's is way, way, way more than that. Almost double the butter and slightly less on the milk. So these things are just, they're divine. Now, croquettes are fried somethings. They are not always potato-based. Carrots or parsnips can be croquettes. Chicken can be croquettes, beef can be croquettes. A croquette back in hors d'oeuvre is made with a fairly rigid ratio of ingredients. So in the hors d'oeuvre version of croquette, in all cases they're fried, half of the total mixture is the puree of the principal thing. Let's say it's chicken. So we're going to have a pound of croquette finished product, 8 ounces is chicken. 4 ounces is flap mushrooms or regular mushrooms. 1/6, I can't do the math that fast. 1/6 is ham, diced small, and 1/12 is truffle. Now, I haven't done the rest of the math, and whatever else is missing, that's the whole thing. It's kind of weird. Escoffier sometimes does kind of strange things. Our potato croquette recipe is much less elaborate. For every kilo of dried pureed potatoes. So the process is the same. In either case, the cut potatoes cooked in boiling salted water or whole potatoes brought up to the boil in salted water, that puree is dried. To every kilo, 2.25 pounds of that, we're going to add 3.5 ounces of butter, salt, pepper, and nutmeg, and mix well on the stovetop so that the steam still comes out and the butter gets to be melted, make sure that it's hot. Remove from the heat and add 4 egg yolks and 1 whole egg. In most cases, Escoffier advises a 2-ounce portion shaped as a cork or in some cases like an apricot as the right size. The primary goal for the croquette size and shape is to have the inside hot and while the outside is well browned. That basic procedure there, dried potatoes, 3.5 ounces of butter, salt, pepper, nutmeg, 4 eggs, and 4 egg yolks and an egg, that's a croquette recipe. And that by itself, you could shape that, 3-step bread them, fry them, and eat them, and be very, very happy. At that stage, when they're finished breading, you can freeze them and then, use them later. Into that mixture, any number of ingredients can be added. The chief caution is to avoid adding so many or so much additional ingredients that the integrity of the mixture is compromised. So into that potato croquette, I would never add half as much of anything. Well, herbs possibly, a whole bunch of chives maybe, a whole bunch of scallions possibly, a whole bunch of ham chunks and mushrooms, never. Instead of nice crispy shapes with stuff, the mixture with things that are big, ham, and also with water. I mean, veggies have water, of course, but not like the ham and the mushrooms. The mixture will not hold together, and it risks falling apart in the fryer, causing no shortage of frustration on the cook part, which is going to be you, and the creation of many new colorful metaphors. So, I would say not more than a quarter of a volume of things like small diced ham or already cooked mushrooms. Anything going into that croquette mixture has to be cooked. It won't actually get cooked in the fryer. It will get hot enough to release whatever water is in it, and that will compromise the integrity of your croquette and risk exploding because the water is going to find a way out. And when that happens, the oil goes in and, well, we can avoid that very easily. So a croquette mixture with, in addition, there's one called Pomme de Terre Bernie. No, not him, B-E-R-N-Y. It's a croquette mixture with 4 ounces of chopped truffle added. Instead of breadcrumbs, Escoffier writes to coat the apricot-sized piece, 2 ounces, in an almond meal. Same three-step breading, flour, egg wash, and then almond meal. Now, truffles aren't something you find in your local grocery store. We've discussed mushroom duxelle before, and that would be perfect here. As a reminder, a duxelle is finely chopped or food processed some mushrooms. Saute that puree of raw mushrooms in whole butter with finely minced shallots on low heat. Now, cook that until the water evaporates and the mushrooms are a thick paste. Add the cooled duxelle to the croquette mixture, and that is a perfectly fine substitute. It isn't going to taste like truffles, but it's going to taste like mushrooms. And in this case, depending on the time of year and where you are in the world, morels would be fine there. Chanterelles would be good there. Porcinis. I'm not sure if I would put porcini in there because I like the hunk of porcini. I like the toothsomeness that the porcini offers. I also like the way chanterelles interact with when you bite them. But morels would make a good duxelle, but that's my preference, not yours. And avoid truffle oil. Seriously, don't buy it. There may be a wee thumbnail-sized piece of truffle peel in the bottle, but the scent is not natural. It's made by the perfume industry. It's made in the factory. And that's about all you may want to know about that. Cheddar cheese, or mostly any cheese you have in the cheese drawer, would be a fine addition into a croquette. Chives are a good flavor and a pretty addition, with the important reminder that not too much cheese, because cheese is fat, and your croquette mixture may not be able to hold the extra fat coming out of the cheese, so just a little bit. You can always make a cheese sauce of the cheese inside to really amp up that cheesy flavor. Now, if you're adding protein, diced ham, diced turkey from cold cuts, for example, leftover braised short ribs, leftover ossobuco, saute it first, get it hot to remove whatever excess water is in there. Every little bit of water we get out of the ingredient before it goes into the croquette is less water we have to worry about destroying all of our work. I mentioned that some of Escoffier's potato procedures start with one whole recipe just to make a whole nother one. Croquette de pomme de terre dauphine is one such procedure. So start with the croquette mixture and add 11 ounces of stiff pate choux. Pain au choux is also called choux paste. We've discussed this before, and it is the dough that makes cream puffs and long johns. It has a variety of other uses too, including a French gnocchi. It puffs up wonderfully when it's cooked, and it will do so here. In some cases, as we've seen before, one item, croquette, formed into a different shape or with a different ingredient is a whole new procedure. Pomme de terre dauphine is one such thing. Instead of making a croquette with the croquette dough, batter, potato, pipe them into a brioche tête mold. I'll cover that in a second. Or use a star tip and pipe them into a little tower, like three or four rotations high, so nice and tight, like just pretty little potatoes, and then do that on a parchment or a baking pan, silicone sheet-lined sheet pan. Brush them either with beaten egg or cream, if you want. Egg is going to be prettier, and cook them until they're golden brown and serve them hot. So a brioche attack. So brioche is like the best bread in the whole wide world. They make the bread pan maker people. They make a little mold that is fluted, means it's ridged. And then at the very bottom, it has a couple of little dimples. And the challenge for the baker is to scale a piece of brioche, round it, put it into that little tin, and then make a teeny tiny round piece of brioche, set it on top like it's a head. A tête means head is the word for head. Tête is the French word for head. So brioche with the head. Now the real skill, and sometimes with a lot of luck, is that baker will bake all of those little rolls and the little head won't be pushed off to one side. So those aren't resealable. The whole idea is that the head is right on top of the little brioche roll and it looks wonderful. And they taste great because they have lots of caramelization on them. So you have lots of good browned flavor. So using those little molds, put your pomme de terre dauphine mix in there or put them on a paper lined sheet pan. That's a whole lot easier. I teased recently that you may be cooking classical French food and not know it. Chicken Maryland, we mentioned, is fried chicken. Sauce mayonnaise is a classical French sauce. Potato chips are a classical preparation. So is straw potatoes, or what we used to call shoestring potatoes. By the way, a double baked stuffed potato, or a stuffed double baked potato, I'm not sure which the order is, that's also in Escoffier's book. I'm going to cover that in a minute. One detail about frying potatoes for chips or shoestrings. Now, mostly for chips. All sizes or shapes for deep-fried potatoes should be rinsed or soaked at least 10 minutes before frying. Now, in some restaurants, we'd put them in the 5-gallon buckets and leave them there for a day or two, and that helps bring a lot of the surface starch, washes them off. Surface starch, if you cut a potato for frying and don't rinse anything off and put it in the fryer, you'll see black, maybe not so much, but variations of brown pattern coming on the outside of the French fry, which is that starch burning or coming close to burning. It will definitely have a overcooked flavor. When you rinse that off, you get a uniform light golden brown color, which is the thing we all say, oh man, look at those great fries. That's how that happens. You have to wash that starch off. The longer the potato sits in the water, the more the starch seeps out, so you get this little, so it's not just the surface now, it's actually from inside the near edge of the potato. So a minimum of 10 minutes, then dry them well. That's important because it's going into hot fat. It's going to splatter. If we dry them well, we can minimize the splattering. If you wear eyeglasses, you know why that's a problem. Now, 350 is a pretty common frying temperature. Now, Escoffier would probably call that hot, or at least medium hot. For for potato chips, especially really thin ones, 300 might be okay, but actually probably 275 might be better, depending on how much fat's in your fryer, if you're on stovetop, if you're actually on a fryer outside by the garage. In the case here, lower might be better because we want as much steam, water, to come out. So what's left is starch and crisp. Burn on a potato won't look like burn on an onion or garlic. If it gets black, obviously it's burned, but even slightly dark brown potato chips will have, for most of us, an unappealing flavor, and I'm not a big fan. I like well brown, but burn is not my thing. So lower the temperature is better for potato chips. Shoestrings can work at 350, and we served shoestrings by the bucketful on a plate with New York Strip years ago, and it's fine. Shoestrings can handle the heat. The chips, they want a little bit more delicacy. French fries, of course, 350 is just fine. One other step for French fries is worth the time to do. The first time you fry them, what? Yes, the first time you fry French fries should be at the low temperature, 275 for about 5 minutes or so. It's not, the time isn't critical. The act is the critical part. That's called blanching. It's not really blanching, but that's what they call it. So when you see it in a recipe, for blanch a French fries, they mean in the fryer, not in water. The purpose is to cook like the steamy, like the like putting the potatoes, for mashed potatoes, into that boiling water. You're cooking the starch first, setting that, and kind of cooking the potato halfway through, and then stopping. After about 5 minutes, roughly, lift the basket out, and if you're not using the fryer for any other purposes, turn your fryer up to 350. If you're doing this on the stovetop, then use your spider, lift them out, put them into a bowl, and elevate the temperature. Get your fryer temperature back to, or get up to, 350 degrees, and then finish frying your French fries. Now, in restaurants that do this, they will blanch baskets and baskets and baskets of French fries, have them on sheet pans ready to go. So when it comes time to do an order of French fries, their potatoes are already blanched, they're ready to fry. At home, we don't need to have sheet pans worth, well, need and want aren't the same. We don't need a sheet pans worth of blanched French fries hanging around. So we can leave them in the basket as long as we're not using the fryer for anything else. Then fry them to the nice golden brown and delicious. And you can kind of push that line a little bit to get them really done and get a little bit of crisp on them. In the potato world, pomme de terre souffle is the pinnacle of frying skills, and sometimes there's just plain dumb luck. So the goal, this is another fried thing. The goal is to fry a thin piece of potato chip so it puffs up like a pillow. Now, Escoffier says, cut your potato into a rectangle. Now, depending on the size of the potato, that's as big as the rectangle is, but let's say it's 2.5 inches or 3 inches by 1.5 and 1.5. Then you're going to, instead of cutting them like the Annas and make coins, you're going to cut these the long way so you make long rectangles. Rinse them to get the fat off, to get the starch off, then dry them. And he writes, the potato is cut into a rectangle, then sliced into slices, quote, approximately 3 millimeters, absolutely even thickness, end quote. Now, the thickness part is really important here. So it has to be the same size beginning to end, or this little magic doesn't happen. Fry them in hot fat, which for us is going to be 350. And then once they're in there, turn the heat up a little bit to engage the thermostat so it heats the oil fast to recover what went in there. Remember the basics of physics. You add something cold relatively into something hot relatively, the temperature is going to drop. We want to recover that heat as fast as possible. And the whole goal is for those little teeny thin rectangles to puff up. So don't crowd the basket, because like maybe five or six per basket. But what we want to have is this giant is relative, this big pillow, this little teeny sliver of potato is going to be this pillow of potato that's going to hold its shape, stay crunchy when it comes out, and it's wonderful when it happens. Good luck. I've had success with this when I didn't intend it, and I've had nearly no success at all when I absolutely wanted it. So done well and correctly, the crunch is a delight, and the airy texture is just giddy fun. Now, I'm told these can be ordered in bistros around France. I've never been there, so I don't know. But if you can make them at home with a really nice sauce, mayonnaise, or something, man, it's just fun. So if you do it, send me a picture. I want to see. The other procedure that sounds the same is soufflé de pommes de terre, a potato soufflé, like actual soufflé. Make 1 pound, 2 ounces of, quote, fairly stiff mashed potatoes finished with a little cream, end quote. Add 3 egg yolks and fold in the stiffly beaten egg whites from those 3 egg yolks. Place in a prepared souffle dish or dishes and bake until done. Now, this is typical for Escoffier. He doesn't offer any sauce suggestion, which kind of we need. It seems any of the cream sauces or cream velouté sauces would be good here. It also seems, I think, a better choice is a demi-glaze would be ideal. All that rich, beefy goodness with the puffy mashed potatoes is almost too grand to think about. Now, he seems unintentionally vague more than a few times. Fairly stiff mashed potatoes. Well, what in the heck is that? Since he does not say what it is, but does say add cream, my suggestion is to omit the milk entirely from the regular mashed potato recipe. Add cream enough to make the mashers somewhat pliable. What is unknown to the cook who has never made a souffle before is the egg yolks will seem to make the mixture runny. Egg yolks, before they are cooked, are nearly all fat. So that extra fat is going to loosen up that potato mixture. All of that loosey part is fixed in the baking because the egg yolks will coagulate. What can't be fixed is the souffle base that is too thin from the beginning. The risk, and for souffles, it's a massive risk, is it will not keep its shape when it comes out of the oven. It may rise fine. As soon as the souffle comes out of the hot oven, 450 or so is what most souffles are baked at, and it hits the relative cold or room temperature, all souffles will fall. Some will fall faster than others. If your base is too thin, it's just not going to hold up. So in this case, a stiffer souffle base is better than a thin souffle base. You can add flavors like truffles or duxelles here. There's this fine line that doesn't have a uniformity. I can't say this is where the line is. The line fluctuates, but here's what the problem is. Adding ingredients, adding stuff to a souffle, diced ham, truffles, duxelles, cheese, is more stuff for this. Trying to make this make sense. So as the souffle is baking, the egg whites are pushing up. They have nowhere else to go because they're in the souffle container. So they go up, and they have a finite amount of strength. They can push that base up just fine. They're very happy to do that. When you put more stuff in there, you're making kind of a heavier souffle. So those 3 egg yolks, like, this is a little bit harder than I thought it was going to be. And it'll probably rise up just fine. But the problem is that it may be too much weight for the finished product to hold. So what's going on the outside, the anatomy of that souffle, the brown part is gelatinized starch and caramelized sugar. Now, it's not table sugar, but potatoes have a lot of sugar in them in the form of starch, and that's going to caramelize. The caramel has some strength that's going to hold that up, but can only hold so much. And if it's too much, it's going to say, I can't do this anymore, and then the souffle falls. So the risk is don't put too much in the chives, herbs, that's not a problem. The better bet, and cheese is the same problem. There's extra fat, which is going to get in the way of everything else and screw up our ratios. And it may come up fine, but it may not last when it comes out of the oven. So the better thing, better meaning a hedge in our favor of souffle success, is figure out how to incorporate those things either as additional components for a sauce. And when you sauce a souffle, dessert or savory, the way that that happens is you open the top, you poke down through the beautiful brown top, open it up, watch the steam come out, and then pour sauce inside. And then as the guest eats through that, every bite of sauce and souffle comes together in one magnificent little bite. So you can make a really potent flavored sauce that's going to have all of the things you wanted to go with that particular souffle. The flavors are added as the sauce goes in, and then that way you have the nice presentation. That's an idea. All right now a quick recap. Mashed potatoes can be mashers. Mashed potatoes can have stuff added to them to make new potato dishes. Add eggs, and you get potato croquettes, which are shaped, three-step breaded, and fried. Use that same croquette mixture, pipe it onto a sheet pan in pretty uniform shapes, and it's another procedure. Add different garnishes, and it's another procedure. Various shapes, oval or round, and different sizes of shapes make different procedures. In most cases, those shapes, the tournées, the balls, the petit pois, the dice, are cooked on the stovetop in clarified fat in one layer. Don't overcrowd your pan. Those Anna potatoes are a new procedure if you add grated cheese. And the Escoffier doesn't indicate which cheese, so we have lots of choices. Personally, given the nature of who he was, where he lived, and what Anna potatoes often are served like a beef dish, Gruyere seems like a fine choice. Highly fat, lots of fat in Gruyere. You're going to get a lot of fat out of an Anna potato anyway. You're going to have a lot of butter left in the Anna pan, but you're going to get a great crunch. That Gruyere would be a good flavor addition. It caramelizes nicely, and the fat remains, is great for eggs the next day. The grated cheese, a finer grate than a coarser grate is better, is between each layer of potatoes, and then the whole thing is cooked the same way. That dish is called Pommes de terre Voisin, V-O-I-S-I-N. Now, two more procedures I want to address. The first is the stuffed baked potato. In some cases, he'll use the scooped potato mixture, finish it by adding garnish, bake it in a small pan, something like that brioche-tête thing, or another small pan of something that's uniform and pretty. Pommes de terre ménagerie, not sure, is a stuffed baked potato. Bake the potatoes, and when they're done, cut the top off. Now, the top means lay it so the long way, like a submarine. Cut the top off, maybe like a quarter inch from the top, and scoop out the insides, taking care not to break the skin. To every 2.5 pounds of scooped baked potato, add 5 ounces of diced ham cooked in butter with 3.5 ounces of cooked small diced onions, and then salt and pepper. Mix that together with a fork. Add 5 ounces of boiling milk to the mixture. Check the seasoning. Make sure it's all mixed up. And then spoon that back into those emptied potato shells. Smooth the surface. Cover with dry breadcrumbs, a little bit of melted butter, bake them until they're hot inside. Remember, we just added boiled milk, so it's going to be pretty warm. Just make sure that they're really hot in the middle, and then brown the tops under a broiler, and you're done. Now, you could invent a whole new dish by changing the ham into breakfast sausage. You could add breakfast sausage and bacon. You could add, in this case, you could add cheese to this because it's not going anywhere. It's staying in that container. You could just, and it's almost endless. Instead of, you could add sour cream and butter. Sour cream gets wonky when it gets hot, but because it's in a container, it might be okay. Now, of course, you can name your new invention anything you want to. The last procedure is similar to the stuffed baked, except it isn't baked. The procedure is for pommes de terre macaire, M-A-C-A-I-R, easy for me to say. We made this at the Governor's Club for probably a beef dish. We made at least one adjustment to the procedure. Scottfish process is this. Bake the potatoes, cut them in half, scoop out the insides. Season with salt and pepper and mash with a fork, adding 7 ounces of butter to every 2 1/4 pounds of potato. Spread the filling, or some part of it, onto the bottom of a hot pan with very hot clarified butter. When browned, flip and brown the other side and serve. So our alterations with this. We food milled that hot potato to make it as smooth as possible. We didn't want any lumps because with a fork, you're not going to get uniformity. We would press that finished mixture into a half sheet pan, making it flat and smooth, and then chill it. For service, so try to visualize, pretend this 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper is a sheet pan, and it's inch and a quarter deep, and it's filled with potato macaire stuff. So take a round cutter, maybe a 2-inch cutter, and along the short edge, cut three rounds of potato out. For service, what we would do, we didn't use the rounds, we made quarter moons. So once you get the round part out, then you can just run down the line and make quarter moons, and you can make 2 quarter moons out of the pieces we made. You don't have to do quarter moons, you can do rounds completely, that's fine. I'm just explaining our process. The tricky parts are the cooking. So as Escoffier was explaining, as I was reading what Escoffier wrote, it sounded like he said, take this pomme de terre macaire mixture, put it into a pan, edge to edge, brown it, flip it, brown it, serve it. Well, there's a couple of problems, or at least challenges. The first challenge is you have to have a very hot pan. And very hot here means like smoking. Not billowing cartoon style smoking, but it needs to be hot. And when you put, and so your fat has to be completely clarified. This is no place for whole butter. It's going to burn instantly, and that will be no good. Clarified butter, lard, clarified anything you're using would be fine. Tallow would be good because it's going, the beef flavor would go great with potatoes. There is an overcrowding issue with pomme de terre macaire, but it's a slightly different problem than the shapes. The chief problem is the bigger this cake of potato stuff is, the more difficult it is to turn it over. All this is potatoes and butter. There's nothing else holding it together. So the starch and the steam is all that's doing this. So my suggestion is with that very hot pan, 2 1/4 pounds is a lot of potato. If you're going to make that much, that's fine. Cut them into rounds with cookie cutters or round is better. Square is fine. Getting into funky edges and things, that's just going to fall apart. Really hot and not too much in the pan because we want to have room to get our utensil in there and flip this thing over. if the pan isn't hot enough, the potato, so let's say we're doing a circle, we're doing a round cookie cut around, like a biscuit cut around. It goes on the pan, it makes a nice sizzle, and we come back in 30 seconds or a minute, and we're looking for this piece of potato to have released itself. Now, that sounds crazy, but in a good seasoned cast iron pan, a good seasoned black steel pan, heck, if you got a Blackstone griddle that's seasoned and hot, that potato will release itself. Does that with, if you do burgers or chicken or anything on the grill, at some point, the griddle, it's going to release itself. If the cooking surface is not hot enough, that will never happen. And what will happen for the McCare is that part will stick. You go to move it, and what will happen is the rest of the potato will slide off the part that stuck to the pan. Now that makes a mess. So hot pan, small pieces, plenty of room to work with in your small pan. And you probably need two tools. One to get under it. And I'm a big fan of offset pastry spatulas. Actually, I really... Those kinds of spatulas you see at Denny's or Waffle House or Waffle Hut or any of these like commercial big pancake spatulas, I hate them because they're too big, especially for the house. They're unwieldy. You can't get into the pan. So smaller offset spatulas, there's something called the Peltex. That's very handy. Two tools, one to get under it and lift it up and flip it over, and the other one to help guide it down, and then you remove the second utensil. And then the potato is going to cook, and then just leave it there. Let it cook so that it starts to sear, cook itself, and then it will release itself. You may need extra clarified butter or clarified fat of your choice by the pan to add a little bit more, because the potato will absorb some of that. Some of it's going to splutter away. And if the pan gets dry and there's no oil in the pan, what will happen is you will get actual for real burn. And that doesn't taste good. So even with those little 4-ounce black steel pans that we would use for any potatoes, that might be the limit of what I would recommend for doing a pan full of pomme de terre McCare, because it's just too hard to work with. The browned surface on the bottom isn't strong enough to hold all the potato on top of it. So it's going to need help, and that's what two tools are for, and that's what a small enough piece of potato to work with is designed to help. We want beauty here. We want success. So doing a full pan is just seems to be inviting a frustration we can easily avoid. Now, there is no version of pomme de terre McCare with chives or truffles. It might work. Chives would be fine. I don't think chives or parsley, fresh thyme, fresh rosemary, I don't think any herbs in any of these things is going to present a problem for integrity. Getting into things like a Duxelles or chopped truffles, I would not put hamburger or any other protein in the McCare just because it just needs all the help it can get, and things getting in the way of that might cause, well, sailor metaphors or cook metaphors, actually. I've heard some beauties. The variety of potato dishes is immense. Now, he only had 59, but we can just go crazy with this. Every ulceration is a new procedure, but not really. If you use Swiss cheese instead of cheddar cheese, it's a brand new procedure, but it's not really a new procedure. It's the same procedure with a small twist. So we know we can make mashed potatoes and add stuff to it. We know that we can make croquettes and add stuff to it. We know we can make duchess and dauphinoise, and we can just go bananas here. And no, bananas and potatoes are not good together. We can make lots of variations based on some very simple, basic procedures. But changing one thing for another, giving it a whole new name, that's how Escoffier do. He knew lots of people that needed to be honored in food, I guess, and that's what he did. What remains in the vegetables chapter are rice, which somehow is weird. It doesn't seem like it belongs to vegetables, but it is. Tomatoes, salsify, which we'll glance over, but it's worth talking about. Jerusalem artichokes and truffles as a vegetable. I think that can be managed in one episode. Then there's the farinaceous products. Four chapters remain. The next chapter, sweets, puddings, and desserts, is huge. And that could go on forever. It's not going to. I'm going to cover some of the real basics. And pastry is a whole other ballgame, but there's a few things that are worth knowing about. And like with potatoes, change this or change that, you have a whole new thing, but not really. What's pretty clear is the principles, stock, soups, sauces, potatoes, vegetable cookery, are the important part. And from those things, innovation and variation stem. All right, folks, that's going to do it. You might think that was too fast going over the potato portion. The keys to Escoffier's potato recipes are butter and more butter, uniformity of shape and size, and a hot pan. The text of this episode will be posted on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/293. Have a great week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.